This is Terrence McNally, and this week you'll hear my conversation with Jay Harmon, who works to translate nature's lessons and models into technologies that solve problems elegantly, efficiently, and economically. We spoke in November 2013.
After 3.8 billion years of R&D on this planet, failures are fossils. What surrounds us in the natural world is what has succeeded and survived. So why not learn as much as we can from what works? Today's guest, Jay Harmon, is doing just that, translating nature's lessons and models into technologies that solve problems and perform tasks more elegantly, efficiently, and economically. Nature, imaginative by necessity, has already solved many of the problems we are still grappling with. Animals, plants, and microbes are the consummate engineers. They found what works, what is appropriate, and most important, what lasts here on Earth. For example, in order to make things, humans usually beat, heat, or treat. That is, we either use intense pressure, intense heat, or powerful solvents to produce the chemical and physical reactions in our manufacturing processes. And it's usually the pressure, heat, and chemicals that produce pollution. But nature seldom uses any of the three. What if we could produce ceramics the way an abalone does, cables the way a spider spins webs, or filter the water the way so many creatures do? What I'm describing is a field or a perspective known as biomimicry, a way of looking and working and designing that has enormous potential to save us from ourselves. I find this one of the most exciting developments in the world at this time. We're now learning how to grow food like a prairie, create color like a peacock, self-medicate like a chimp, compute like a cell, and run a business like a hickory forest. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. An award-winning entrepreneur and inventor, Jay Harmon, has founded and grown multi-million-dollar research and manufacturing companies that develop, patent, and license innovative products, ranging from prize-winning watercraft to interlocking building bricks, afterburners for aircraft engines, and non-invasive technology for measuring blood glucose and other electrolytes. His latest ventures, PAX Scientific, PAX Water Technologies, PAX Mixer, and PAX Streamline, design more efficient industrial equipment, including refrigeration, turbines, fans, mixers, and pumps, based on Jay's revolutionary concepts that imitate nature. He's the author of The Shark's Paintbrush, Biomimicry, and How Nature is Inspiring Innovation. Welcome, Jay Harmon, to Free Forum.
Well, thank you. And I must say, I just love your summation of biomimicry. I could see you doing an article for a Wall Street Journal. That was fabulous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. One thing, Jay, is that I like people to get a feel for the people, not just the ideas and the work that we talk about. I want my listeners to get a feel for you. So I hit some highlights there, but can you, in your own words, tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today? Feel free to cite mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Okay. Well, let's see. Wind the clock back. I grew up in the outback in Australia, which was a great blessing for me. So scarcely populated country, 20 million people in a country the size of the U.S. And I grew up in the desert and also on the coast, on the west coast of Australia. And wasn't really interested in school. In fact, I had some learning disabilities, which weren't diagnosed at the time. But what I found was solace in nature and fascination in nature. So every second I had, even when I was supposed to be in school, I was usually absconding and I was down at the beach or in the bush somewhere. And I got really, really fascinated with the way that fish swim because I wanted to catch fish. You know, when I was 9, I made a little spear out of a broomstick and put a nail on the end of it, and I chased fish around. And it was an impossible job, of course, but I was fascinated by these fish. And I noticed how they swam, and I also noticed that there were recurring patterns in nature, in the water, in the way, the shape of waves and the shape of seaweeds as they changed shape to let waves go past, and in octopus tentacles. So I just got more and more fascinated with that. And I also
let me ask you a question.
Yes,
let me interrupt you and ask a question. Was there anyone you could talk about that with? Or was this something that sort of played around inside you for years?
No, it was totally personal because I found no books on these subjects. I went to Jesuit school, and certainly the Jesuits were more interested in science and languages, et cetera, but not nature.
Okay.
So nature wasn't front and center in the 60s.
Yeah. So continue, though. I just wanted to get that feeling of this 9- or 10-year-old who's noticing these things, and whether there was a teacher or a mentor or anyone. No. At that point, it's just your own private discoveries.
In hindsight, I'd say nature was the mentor.
There we go.
And thoroughly. And I was really immersed in it, and I used to daydream about nature and diving and making boats, and I used to daydream about designing submarines looking like fish and all sorts of things. And so I did worse and worse at school, but I got better and better at understanding some of the natural forces that were happening. And I started making canoes when I was very, very young, and they were just made out of sheets of old corrugated iron that I would fold into shapes and fasten the ends. And I thought, well, if I could change these canoes into the shape of fish, then they'd go better. So I got out my hammer and I beat on this iron. And I got these curved shapes into my canoes, and they seemed to go better. So I was off and running. And so when I left school, parents want us to be the best we can be, of course. So I went off to college and studied electronic engineering, which I did not enjoy. So after a couple of years, I ran away to sea with the Fisheries and Wildlife Department, and spent quite a few years at sea and eventually became a captain of research and patrol vessels. But all of that time, I was given incredible opportunities to look at nature up close and personal all over the country. And so that really set me up.
And now, it does seem to me that – and I've spent a little time on board ships and sailing and so on. It does seem to me that that is a field – that does notice nature, that is so dependent on the vicissitudes of nature, whether it's the wind, the rain, or the waves, that in fact your approach was – you weren't alone at that point.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's the thing. You said it perfectly, especially when you're doing blue water sailing. Weather is everything from the second you get up in the morning. In fact, before you wake up in the morning, you know what the weather is. And if it changes, you wake up. And so you're on this little cork in the middle of this vast ocean, so you're completely immersed in nature and you're at the pleasure of nature. And just by our wits' ends, we get by sometimes.
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking of Buckminster Fuller,
mm-hmm.
Albert Einstein.
Right.
Both sailors.
Right.
Who saw things that others didn't see.
Right. Well, you don't have a choice. That's the wonderful thing about nature, particularly at sea. But I think anybody that spends a lot of time in wilderness and fully immersed realizes that we are really a tiny little seed in this massive environment. And the only way to go forward is to surrender to it and understand and as best you can and fit. Rather than trying to have nature fit us, we fit nature.
Okay. I want to get into your – when you shift careers and so on. I want you to tell us a little bit about that. But first, I want people to know that this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and the other voice is Jay Harmon, an inventor and entrepreneur who develops innovative products by adapting lessons he learns from nature. And we're talking about his work and the ideas in his new book, The Shark's Paintbrush. You can learn more at The Shark's Paintbrush, one word – .com or PaxScientific.com, which is one of his companies. Okay, so at some point you leave the sea.
Well, yes, and in fact I got promoted off boats, and then I was in charge of different districts and things on the mainland, and I was a pearling superintendent. I worked in the last days of the whaling industry, supervising whaling, and so I was exposed to lots and lots of different theaters, if you like. And what I noticed was that, I would spend months or years working on a project, a conservation project, or trying to safeguard a conservation site. And then at the whim of government, that site might be turned over to Alcoa for bauxite mining or property developers for canal developments, right? And all the pelican nesting sites are obliterated. So I found that terribly disheartening. And I thought, well, there has to be a way that I could leverage, you know, my passion for nature in a better way. So I thought, well, I had seen how nature manages to streamline things so beautifully in fish and birds and insects, etc. And I noticed that nature's shapes weren't being adopted by technology and engineering. And I thought, okay, I know it works on boats. So why don't I go into business and create nature-based tools? This is before biomimicry was coined as a word. So I sort of felt I was pretty much acting alone in the world, and of course in a remote place of the world. And so I went into the commercial world to start building these tools.
And?
Well, it was a rocky road. And I started a company in Australia, which very quickly became less biomimic and more a way to actually get traction and success and capital so that I could come back to biomimicry.
Well, okay.
That company turned into an extremely successful one. Ultimately became the biggest technology company in Australia, ERG Australia. I left that company and started, well, I went to sea again. I actually built a sailboat and took off and sailed nearly 30,000 miles in different parts of the world and collecting more and more information about nature. And in fact, I guess I wasn't doing the collecting. Nature was imposing it on me.
You know, sure.
You get to collect this, right? Did you learn that lesson?
So, right.
So then I started a series of companies, boat building companies with radical design changes in boats and how you build boats and how you get energy efficiency. And those boats did very well. I sold several thousand of them. And then I needed a better propeller for these boats. You know, a friend of mine years ago had killed his son, unfortunately. The son had been sitting on the bow of his boat. It hit a wave. The son had gone off the bow, and the fellow had run over his son with his propeller. So my boats were selling so well, I became more and more nervous that a lot of novices were using these boats, and I didn't want people to be risking themselves with propellers. So I thought, well, nature doesn't build propellers, but is really good at propulsion.
That's
so
right.
I started going down that path, and I came up with a propeller that was safe, and I came up with, you know, from there it became clear, well, if it's a propeller, it could be a fan. And then as it evolved, as this concept evolved, I saw it could be all sorts of things, and from the shape of boats to rotating machinery to wind turbines to the shape of aircraft to even the way that refrigeration is done. You know, the 100 years we've had refrigeration on Earth is not based on natural principles, yet nature is extremely good at heating and cooling. And so what are the principles at work there? Well, it turns out they're exactly the same principles that nature bases all of its streamlining designs on. So once I tapped into this streamlining shape, which are spiraling shapes that we see throughout nature, then I had the key to the kingdom, if you like, the key to really being able to reinvent pretty much everything that the industrial world is doing, whereas technologists.
So that's the voice of Jay Harmon. We're talking about his work and his new book, The Shark's Paintbrush. Now, this is interesting. What you're saying is that you, rather than looking for the next piece of information or the next iteration of what's already come before, are looking for much more basic principles.
You find
this principle of the spiral works and shows up all across nature. Talk just a little bit about that. Why the spiral?
Okay. Well, let me start with this. As physicists acknowledge, and the mystics of history, nothing exists in this universe except energy, bottom line. Even the chair we're sitting on is made of atoms, which are just little energy fields. So there's no such thing as a particle. And even in the particle accelerators in the world, we don't actually see particles. We see where we think they've been. So if you look at photographs from cloud chambers and things, you see these spiraling shapes. Well, it so happens that all of this energy in our universe is constantly moving, and it's all moving in the shape of what physicists call turbulence. Everything's turbulent. And you just have to look at clouds going by or the fog coming over the hills or water coming out of the faucet.
And that's the term they use, turbulence. What does turbulence mean?
Turbulence is really a whole lot of spiraling flow that is becoming whirlpools or vortices. Vortices themselves or vortices decaying into swirling flows again to become more vortices. So
whether air or moisture
or energy
water,
or light or sound or anything, right? So what is actually happening is that this entire universe that's made of energy that is all moving is moving in spiraling shapes. And contrary to, let's see, human invention since the start of the Industrial Revolution, nature never, ever, ever creates a straight line.
I knew that was the next
one. I love being able to say that because it's such a fundamental place to get to. Right?
Yes. In other words, when you look at the urban environment,
right?
I mean, the studio we're sitting in right now,
right.
And the house we came out of,
right.
The table we sit at,
yep.
It's straight line after straight line after straight line.
Exactly.
Even as you look at agriculture,
uh-huh.
Even
straight
those
fences.
Beautiful patterns, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of straight lines.
Yes.
And yet nature, there are no straight lines.
Never have been. And in actual fact, a purely straight line is impossible, even for humans. So what do I mean by that? If you take a facet of a diamond, which we think, wow, that's pretty crisp and straight. Look at an electron microscope and you see there are spiraling shapes there. There are no straight lines. And every living thing goes through a liquid phase in its development, so it takes on the geometry of water movement. And water always moves in spirals. Even when we see water going down a straight pipe, the water inside is spiraling.
Right.
And when we breathe in and out of our bodies through the trachea, that's all spiraling as well. Our trachea are spiraling. And our whole cardiovascular system is spiraling. We've got 60,000 miles of plumbing in our bodies, and it's all spiraling.
You know, I'll just tell you a brief thing. I'm currently dealing with staph infection in my knee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm infusing antibiotics. The nurse, who hasn't read your book, said when you're putting in a plunger full of saline,
mm-hmm.
You put force on the plunger,
right.
So that you will create a vortex so that
nice.
You will have more juice,
right.
In that where the tube meets, you know, where the stuff begins to go in the tube. So somewhere she picked that up, and it's
right.
The very same thing you're talking about, isn't
right.
it?
Well, you know, similarly to that, if you pull the plug out of the bath anywhere in the world, you get
one direction or the other, but
yeah.
It always goes in.
It always goes in a spiral. Exactly. So nature doesn't do anything else. And there's not a single example since the beginning of time. There's nothing in the fossil record. There's nothing that any physicist or scientist can point to where nature has used a straight line for anything. So here's this fundamental difference. We got humans building everything with straight lines because we think, well.
And acting as if forces move in straight lines, right?
That's exactly
right.
That's
why the pipes are set up that way and the valves are set up that way and even the fans and the pumps that
right.
you briefly referred to before.
That's right. And for instance, if you think of pumping and piping, which uses around about a third of the world's energy every year.
Yeah, and it explain to people why that is, because I would imagine you go, how? But it turns out that your refrigerator, your car,
mm-hmm. All the water that gets
and
delivered,
every factory that's manufacturing anything,
right.
is
pumping something,
pumping, heating, and cooling. Right.
What are oil companies? They're pumping companies.
That's
what
right.
an oil company does. It pumps oil. It's the biggest activity.
So what you're saying is pumping uses a third of the energy.
Yes.
Wow. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Jay Harmon. He's an inventor and an entrepreneur. He develops innovative products by adapting lessons learned from nature, as you can hear. We're talking about his work and the ideas in his new book, The Shark's Paintbrush, and you can learn more at thesharkspaintbrush.com or paxscientific.com, which is one of his companies.
Yeah, so, of course, we're taught in school that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, right? Well, that makes sense. We're also taught that if you want to use the least energy, you go from between those two points in a straight line. Well, that all makes sense, except that nature doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Nature does a spiraling path.
That's an interesting contradiction.
Right. A fundamental contradiction. So nature always takes a longer path to get there because a spiral is longer than a straight line, always takes a longer path, always uses less energy. Go figure.
Ah,
right.
So now the contradiction has meaning.
Right, exactly. So without going into the detail of why that is, because it's not really well understood, what we can do is say, well, if nature's doing that, why don't we have a second look at how we're doing things, see if we can adopt these spirals. Well, then it gets a little tricky because these spirals are not random, and they all come down to common math with just a handful of variables. That's never been understood. So for the last 30 years, we've been at PAX, been working on reverse engineering those spirals, natural spirals, to find out what are the commonalities of them.
So in other words, what dimensions, what relationships
exactly.
In that spiral are the ones that provide the sort of the magic sauce
exactly.
of efficiency and elegance and so on?
That's right. And you have to get it right because it's not haphazard.
In other words, merely replacing straight line with a spiral is not the ticket.
No, you have to get the spiral right. And
as the shell does, as the
exactly.
Yeah.
And so we've worked with numerous PhD scientists, physicists, engineers. We've worked with numerous universities. We now have a huge body of knowledge on this subject. We have supercomputers. And we've worked in all sorts of fields, from atmospheric scale right down to tiny little devices for moving air in your computer to moving heat, because heat travels the same way. And we've now got literally thousands of prototypes across many, many industries that clearly demonstrate.
That's what I was going to say. How close are you to mimicking nature well?
I think we're extremely good at getting the math right and mimicking the spiraling shapes as they should be. There are a couple of little problems. And one is that pretty much when humans build stuff, it's solid. Like the skin of an aircraft is solid. A pump is a solid thing. When nature builds something, it's flexible, mostly, right? And even if you see eroded rock, you know, like the Grand Canyon, you'll see spiraling shapes in all sorts of rocks in the Grand Canyon, and you think, well, that's solid. Yes, it is, but not for long, because nature's always eroding and those patterns are always changing.
And also nature has a different definition of what for long is.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you think of the heart pumping through the cardiovascular system, our veins are flexing and pulsing. So as the pressure of the blood changes, the piping changes.
So one would look at a vein and say, now that's looks like a straight line.
Yeah, it looks like it.
And what you're
not.
Saying is that because of the way it's constantly in motion, it's not really so.
But even if you look at it carefully, you'll notice that it's not in a straight line. Even the solid what appears to be solid is not in a straight line. There are all these swirls in an artery, but those arteries change with the different conditions. And of course, cardiovascular disease is partly formed by the fact that our arteries calcify and get hard and they don't pulse. Mm. And when they don't pulse, then we start to get sedimentation and that becomes a problem. And it's like pipes. We put in a straight pipe. I don't know if you've ever broken open an old pipe that's had water going through it for 30, 40 years. But inside, you'll find calcification all spiraling up just like an artery. And eventually, it'll block the pipe.
So that we can broaden this, if you can imagine getting broader than what we've already said, but broaden it so that we can talk about other lessons of nature. What is the state at this point of your work with the spiral in terms of pumps and fans and those sorts of things?
Well, we have lots and lots of – what we've created is a number of different subsidiaries to focus on different industries. And we have a fan company that has built hundreds and hundreds of different fans. There's not a fan in the world today that's been presented to us that we can't improve. And very significantly in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of noise reduction, because nature doesn't like to make a noise unless it's mating, right? Or it's in terror. The rest of the time, pretty much things are quiet because if you're a predator, you've got to be quiet. If you're prey, you've got to be quiet.
Ah, right. So in other words, what you're saying is that at least in organisms, the system works quietly.
Right. And pretty much that's the case. And noise in a fan or a pump or an engine is telling you that that system is inefficient. If you make it efficient, then the noise drops way down. And so we've created lots of these kinds of fans. We have a water mixer that's in the in municipal water tanks throughout the country now. It's more than 800 of these huge big reservoirs we see, where the water can go stagnant. And we put in this tiny little frozen whirlpool. You imagine you pull the plug out of the bath, you get that whirlpool, and then you freeze it. So now you've captured it.
Do you mean literally freeze it?
Freeze it.
Cold?
Yes.
Okay.
So imagine now you've extracted this thing.
The shape
of a whirlpool that's actually looks like a tornado or a hurricane or anything else, and it's got the streamlines of that whirlpool. And so what we did was we created this 6-inch high by 4-inch wide impeller, and we put it on a little motor. And we put it in imagine a 10 million gallon tank of water. That's an enormous amount of water.
Now, so again, we're talking 6 inches by?
4 inches.
By 4 inches in a 10 million gallon tank.
That's a tank that's 400 feet across.
So larger than a football field across.
Right, 30 feet high.
Okay.
Right, massive tank. This tiny little thing, it's like a grain of sand in the middle of it. We rotate that. And by the way, when we took this to industry, they said, yeah, right, you're smoking the wrong stuff. You're from California, isn't it?
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
So it took us a little while to convince people, but we've put it in these tanks and we rotate it with enough power to run a couple of light bulbs, and it completely circulates that water body, completely. And what we've been able to achieve is an 85% drop in the chemicals that go into water normally as disinfectants. So chlorine and chloramines, we've been able to
reduce
it.
They're not needed. They're not needed because it's circulating.
Exactly right. Now, that sounds too good to be true.
It does.
But it is true, and we're in 800 different municipalities. And anybody wants to have a look to see what this is all about, paxwater.com.
Okay.
And paxwater.com. And you'll see the shapes that we're using. Now, the reason for that is that nature is spectacularly efficient. And if you think of hurricanes and tornadoes, what we're seeing is just the center of a flow structure that looks like a donut. It's called a ring vortex. Whatever goes up has to come down. So it goes up, and it just looks like a donut, round and round and round. And the atmosphere is full of these, and that's what we fly over. You know, we get turbulence and so forth. That's what you see pelicans circling on with that lift. The oceans are full of it. This room is full of ring vortices. Nature uses them everywhere it can because a ring vortex is almost frictionless.
Uh-huh.
Humans don't use them for anything, right? We're really into making friction and wasting energy. Nature's really into not wasting energy at all. So the center of a ring vortex looks just like this little impeller that I described to you. So when we rotate that in 10 million gallons of water, we create a virtually friction-free ring vortex.
Wow.
So we get all of that, a huge advantage for a tiny effort.
Excellent, excellent. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. He's Jay Harmon. He's an inventor and an entrepreneur. He develops innovative products, as you've just heard, by adapting lessons learned from nature. We're talking about his work and the ideas in his new book, The Shark's Paintbrush. You can learn more at thesharkspaintbrush.com and packscientific.com. And as he pointed out, for certain specific technologies, it'll be PAX Water, PAX
Fan, yeah.
PAX, yeah, and so on. But you'll find it. Okay, so I think we've got a sense of how you started and what you're working on these days. Now let's step back and Let me ask you a few things about biomimicry, and I think we've obviously done a great job of putting it in demonstration, but I want to ask a few questions. So one of the ways that I've thought of it is that organisms in nature have circumstances, needs, problems that they have to solve, and as I said at the start, for us to do these things, we often need extreme something, extreme heat, extreme pressure, extreme solvents, toxins. Nature does these things at room temperature, if you will. It has lots of time to operate, and it seldom uses enormous pressure. Not never, but seldom. So some of the methods that we found to jumpstart things or catalyze things or make things happen on our schedule or in the place we wanted were things that other organisms don't have in their repertoire. So if we could learn to do things without these, now we're acting more like them. That's where we get the efficiency gains, the lack of pollution, that things become sustainable. Could you expand a bit on that?
Let's say the time issue, right? Because as you said, nature's got all the time in the world in a sense.
In a sense, but then if you're a firefly,
yeah,
you have very little relative to us.
Exactly. But a species, you know, may be around for millions of years.
That's right.
But we don't have to take that time to evolve from where we are to what nature can teach us, because nature, the model is right there, right now.
They've done the R&D.
They've done that for this moment in time. Now, as you said, things are changing all the time. So nature will adapt today's species for tomorrow's conditions. Right now, we're going through this extraordinary climate change, which is a bigger change than nature has experienced in many millions of years. And it's rare that it's this fast, though it does happen. You know, asteroids or massive volcanoes and things puts pressure on species kind of overnight, and nature takes some time to adapt to that. But for today's conditions, nature has evolved models that we can analyze and recreate almost overnight. And the beauty is that today we have the tools to do this.
By the way, you anticipated my second thing I was going to say. So in timing, we had this time where we where we could sort of get away with it, that our excess disposal, our excess resource usage, our excess population hadn't shown up yet as a critical factor. But that's the bad news about the timing. We've reached that point where these things are now putting pressures on us. By the same token, it happens that at this moment of time, we've created certain technologies in computers and so on that allow us to adapt much more quickly.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. Who changes anything unless it's a crisis, right? Nature doesn't change unless there's a threat.
A fire.
Yeah, exactly. Humans don't really change. I mean, we get up, we do our day-to-day stuff, and, you know, we look for a bit of entertainment, a little pain relief, and, you know, that's about it. And we just keep doing the same thing. When there's a real crisis, we change overnight. America went from a sleepy country to the greatest power the world's ever seen in 4 years in the Second World War.
World War II.
Exactly. Phenomenal. Yeah. I mean, that's never happened at that scale ever. But I mean, humans demonstrate that in many, many ways over a very long history. So this crisis that we're in right now is the fuel. And Paul Hawken described us as the tools of nature's immune response system, right?
We are the tools of nature's response system.
Yeah,
okay.
Because we are in this crisis, a lot of it man-made, a lot of it not so. It's just this is the vagaries of life. And we're in a kind of a perfect storm, and we're facing phenomenal crises. But we have the intellect. I mean, we do have the intellect and the tools to be able to mitigate a lot of the difficulties we're facing right now and to create something fresh and new, because that is nature. It's always creating fresh and new.
So one piece of it is we can fail to innovate. We can fail to evolve. But on the other side, we can evolve much quicker than nature.
Absolutely, we can. Absolutely. Because all of the models are there for us to learn from. Trillions and trillions of solutions that nature has spent this enormous R&D budget on, research and development budget on, for billions of years, and it's all there in front of us. All we have to do is peer in with an appetite to discover what's off on offer and then adapt. And the beauty is that biomimicry as a word was only coined 15 years ago, and the crisis has really only been seen by most people for around the last 10 or 15 years. And there's been this kind of avalanche now. There's more than 200 products out there, some of them making billions of dollars.
He can't help using natural metaphors.
There you go. Yeah. So there is an economy that's growing and exploding right now of biomimicry products and solutions. And the Firminian Institute at Point Loma Nazarene University is...
Say that one more time. I didn't get the...
The Firminian.
Firminian.
Institute. Okay. Yeah, it's at the Point Loma Nazarene University. They've done some serious looking at biomimicry and its impact on the world and the economies, et cetera. They're predicting $1 trillion of GDP within 13 years from now and 1.6 million jobs in the U.S. just because of biomimicry. We're right at the cusp of a major shift. And it's not just these spirals that I've been talking about. People are looking at chemistry. They're looking at materials, at nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, for instance, is biomimetic. That's how nature builds everything, one molecule at a time. So there's no waste. There's no cutoffs. There's no – or offcuts. There's no sawdust. There's no gases polluting.
Let's talk about waste for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying is that by building the way nature does, of course there's no waste because it's always embedded in a system mm-hmm. where the off-put of one species or one organism is picked up by another and so on. And humans have indulged the luxury of waste to an enormous extent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what are we doing? I mean, if you look at it at a macro level, we're converting the world's resources into a waste pile, right? Those waste piles, our garbage pits, or, you know, in some parts of the world like New York, it's all dumped off the edge of the continental shelf into the ocean. So millions and billions of tons of waste are resources that have just been encapsulated in ways that can never be used
again.
Something
I hear like 94% of what you purchase is either waste or will be within 6 months.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
And look at nature. Nature doesn't waste anything. There's no such thing as waste in the natural vocabulary. There is no waste because effluent or byproduct from anything is a resource for something else.
And that's true even of poisons?
Everything. Everything. There's nothing that that isn't a useful resource for the creation. And typically, the conditions conducive to life. Nature's always looking to establish the conditions conducive to life. And humans, unfortunately, are going the opposite direction at this point.
Okay. Let me ask another big question about biomimicry. It seems to me, and I've read it more than one place, there are three levels of imitating nature. The thing that strikes me as the most obvious for people to get are the material things, the mm-hmm. cables modeled on spider webs, the pumps modeled on fins or whatever. But we can also model processes, right, how something is done, mm-hmm. and even systems, how processes are organized. Mm-hmm. We can model all that after nature. Can you talk a bit about that? Because I think that's a little more subtle and a little harder to get.
Well, swarm logic. You know, there are wonderful research programs going on today looking at how bees communicate with each other and how a hive is organized and how bees can radiate around for miles and all come back and communicate with each other. Or ants' nests where you've got thousands, tens of thousands of ants all trekking back and forth and they never have traffic jams. Right, they're communicating, and there are folks that are looking at how ants do that for how we can improve our freeway systems, and they're actually implementing it. There are systems in Germany now that have actually found they can make freeways flow better just by adopting ant approaches. Nature is phenomenal at organizing. If you like, this entire planet is one organized system.
Of course.
There's nothing actually disorganized in it, even though it looks chaotic. to the untrained eye, or if we just take one piece out of isolation.
That's right.
If we look at the pattern of leaves on the ground, we think, oh, well, that's not disorganized.
It's chaos, yeah.
But it's all one organism and one organized system that functions and maintains life.
So if we're talking about systems then, would the applications for that kind of thing be within a business organization or a political organization?
Absolutely. And boy, there's some great examples out there. Interface Carpets, wonderful company. The CEO of Interface some years ago, Ray Anderson, had an epiphany, and he saw that an enormous amount of carpet was ending up in landfill in America. I mean, every waste carpet, everything that gets replaced ends up in landfill. And there's, I think it was 5 million tons of this stuff a year or some enormous amount.
Yeah, it's a big number.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, well, this is ridiculous. And so he decided that his company was going to recycle everything. And he changed the entire company. He changed the way carpet is designed and made. And now it's zero waste in terms of its carpet. It's now the biggest carpet tile manufacturer in the world. It's a $1 billion business. And he's aiming – unfortunately, he's passed away now.
His company is aiming.
But certainly his ethic and his vision has been passed on. And that company now is heading for zero waste of any description.
Right. Let me just give a couple of the insights that Ray Anderson and Interface did, and I've actually had Ray on the show and worked with them a little bit. One is the whole notion of a carpet tile, which is that it used to be, for as long as people could remember, you had a carpet. And if there was a spot that suddenly you couldn't remove, you had to replace the entire carpet. And what Interface began to do was make carpet tiles, maybe a yard by a yard. So if that's where the stain was, you yank that out and replace just that. That was one. The other is that he really realized that he was throwing money down the drain with any waste. And so he just said it's not about – I mean, it doesn't have to be about the planet or about saving anything or about being a good person. It's just if we can reduce the waste in the way we design everything we do, it's better for our bottom line.
Exactly. And then the other thing he did, which I think is just a stroke of genius, he looked at how nature has what the forest floor looks like in nature, which is kind of random and chaotic when we first look at it. And he took those patterns and he put it into his carpet tiles. So now he can put his carpet tiles in with any orientation he wants, and it all looks beautiful. And like you say, if there's a worn piece or a stained piece, he just takes it out and puts in a new piece.
And the other principle that he wasn't the only one, but Interface really took to heart, is that in fact people do not want to buy products. They may think they're buying products, but what they're really buying is services.
Right.
That what you buy when you buy a carpet is warmth, comfort, beauty. I guess that's really it. And when you begin to think about your job as a company is to deliver a service rather than a product, it changes everything.
Exactly.
And that's nature again. Nature doesn't have products.
That's
nature
right.
Nature is all services.
That's it. Exactly right. Exactly.
Okay. Anything in terms of politics?
Well, you know.
And if not yet, I understand.
Well, here's the thing. I think about that sometimes, especially when you hear of all of this discord in Washington and places like that. But if you look at nature, there's a ton of discord when it comes to power plays, right? You've got two stallions fighting over a brood of mares, right? There's no nicety there. It's full on. And they'll use every trick in the book. You know, does nature lie? Well, of course it does. It's got camouflage. It's got all sorts of trickery,
yes.
Right? So that it can get to eat or not be eaten. So if you really look at it, humans at pretty much any level are being creatures of nature. The thing that's missing, though, is the possibility of human intellect and compassion. I think that's not as evolved as it could be in some of the forums. Of course, most humans have a heart and come from the heart in many ways. But we seem to be able to leave that behind when it comes to certain activities like politics. So there's obviously things to learn there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky one. You also – you organized the Shark Paintbrush. This goes a little bit to what I was just saying before about three different ways of biomimicry. But you organized the Shark's Paintbrush into three parts. In part one, you give a basic understanding of biomimicry, much of what we've been talking about. But from a business perspective, in part two, you begin to show the applications currently in research and development. And in part three, principles of running a bio-inspired business. Could you talk a little bit about each of those three pieces of the book?
Sure. Let's see. Where are we?
He wrote it a long time ago. He's looking at my question.
I did. I've moved on in many ways. The first part of the book is really just showing, okay, what is biomimicry and how does this affect us? And there's some wonderful anecdotes in there, as you know, from other researchers, like sunblocks, which we can come back to. And there's just, as you probably agree, there's some really fun little stories in there. So biomimicry itself, I think, and my colleagues think, is really the salvation of the earth. It's the way to reinvent all of the systems that we've done poorly.
We had the luxury, it appeared, to
exactly.
do so.
Exactly. And we've been extremely clever. I mean, what have we done in the last 300 years as a species? It's phenomenal. But we're coloring outside the lines. Have we optimized? No, we haven't. But because we haven't had the skills to even understand what we were doing completely, right? So now we can go back and color inside the lines, and we can optimize these systems. So the second part of the book, I'm really showing some of the really exciting things that different researchers are doing. I'm continuing on with the first part. But a lot of adventure stories of how these things get discovered as well. And then in the last part, it's really about what are the opportunities, who's doing what, and the implications for the world at large.
Talk a bit about that.
Well, I personally think that there's not a system on Earth, there's not a product on Earth that can't be improved significantly. I think if we really adopt biomimetic practices, we can reduce the world's energy bill by at least 2/3. Without sacrifice. That means we eliminate 2/3 of the pollution. And even when we come down to that 1/3 left energy that we need, because from nature's point of view, there's no such thing as an energy shortage, never has been and never will be.
Right.
Right? Even if we reduce down to that 2/3, that 1/3 that's left can be completely clean with zero pollution. That is achievable. And people say, oh, well, how could that possibly be? And I say, look at nature. Nature is far more complexity, far more systems, far more species than just us. There are far more exploits going on in the world than just our little worlds. And it's all sustainable outside our sphere. So absolutely we can copy those things. That allows us to seriously think about solving our problems in the short term, within a couple of decades, literally.
Because that was going to be my next question. What's the timeline of what you're talking about? Because when you hear people talk about the threat of climate change, mm-hmm. the projections are, you know, by 2050, by 2100, where will we be? Or population, mm-hmm. or any of these things. And you're saying that if we – and my guess is, like Lester Brown does, that analogy of World War II mobilization is some of what you're talking about, aren't you?
Exactly. And look, you know, I was incredibly idealistic as a kid and a young man. And I thought, well, let's go forward and show the world how to do this. And everybody will go, hooray, we'll take it on. Let's do it. Well, it doesn't really work like that. And I hit my head against that wall over and over and over and over again. But one day I was giving a talk to a bunch of people and some of them were distracted. And I was putting out as much energy as I could. And I thought, something just struck me, and I said to the crowd, how much wealth would you like to have in your life individually? I had everybody's attention just like that. And, you know, we all have attention on that in some way or other. We all want to be more comfortable. We want to have our bills paid. We want to have less stress. And we identify a lot of those things with how much money we've got. Okay, so here's a bottom line in our world. And, of course, the world is run by accountants. The bean counters of the world, everything comes down to the bottom line. Where's the wealth? Okay. Very hard to get humanity to change to new paradigms if you have to sacrifice, if you're going to be less wealthy, if you're going to be less comfortable. So you have to show how you're going to be more wealthy and more comfortable. I mean, it's really that simple. And the beauty of it is that biomimetic products do two things. They create more wealth and they limit liability. If you do biomimetic chemistry, because nature has done many more chemicals than the 80,000 that humans have created, and most of ours have got all sorts of side effects and toxicity and kill things. And look at the pharmaceutical advertisements on television. They're all telling you, well, here's this wonderful product that'll cure you, but it might kill you.
And then they read the side effects.
Yeah, exactly. Right, quickly, so we can increase wealth significantly, and we can reduce liability.
And liability, you mean two things. One, if you're talking to a business,
right,
you mean legal and financial liability.
Exactly.
But if you're talking outside of the mere business context, you mean the side effects, the unintended consequences, the negative consequences of a positive
exactly
thing. Okay.
So human race is on a career of unsustainability, period. That's what we're doing. You know, there are little pockets here and there, people trying to do stuff. But as a species, we are headlong hurtling towards a completely unsustainable future. Nature, on the other hand, is clean, green, and sustainable. Absolutely clean, green, and sustainable. So if we adopt biomimicry, the world creates more wealth and it has a sustainable future. It's as simple as that. And the evidence is there now. There are so many companies that are proving this. It's beyond conflict.
Okay. Let me ask you almost what you answered there.
Mm-hmm.
But well, I'm going to ask you one short one, and then I'm going to ask you a big one. Are you familiar with the Wyss Institute at Harvard?
No.
No?
No.
Oh, well, then I won't make this a question. I'll just tell you to check this out.
Okay.
In January 2009, Harvard received the largest philanthropic gift in its history.
Wow.
And believe me, Harvard knows how to raise money.
Right.
This was $125 million, and the donor has since doubled down.
Wow.
To create the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering.
Oh, lovely.
And that is what they are up to.
Mm.
So check that out. I was going to ask
absolutely.
You. I was going to ask you. And the other thing that's very interesting about the Wyss Institute, Jay Harmon, is that the guy in charge of it really sees things not like a corporation, not like academia. He's got everyone intermixed there. Designers, corporate marketers, academics, and he said to Harvard, this is the way it's got to run if we're really going to make a difference.
Beautiful.
So check
beautiful.
This out, the Wyss Institute.
Beautiful.
My question, and this could be kind of the last question, is to put on your science fiction cap and stand in the future, stand in 2050, let's say. And the question is, did we turn things around or not? And my guess is that you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if you didn't think we could or would. And if so, tell us that story.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back to 2013, what were some of the things that happened along the way that saved our bacon?
Okay. I can certainly answer this from my point of view. 50 years from now, we're looking back and we're saying this is the most important turning point in human history. Social media and the internet.
50 years, we're looking back and saying this.
Yes.
The
beginning of this century,
yeah.
Right? Social media and the internet means we're sharing ideas instantly. There are movements happening instantly. Already we have more than 200 major products in the marketplace that are showing that biomimicry creates more wealth with less liability than any other thing we can do. That is becoming a landslide. And I suspect that we're going to see a huge explosion in information around this and adaptation. There's going to be an investment bubble like there has been in every other, you know, gold rush. That's going to be problematic. It's going to be great for a little while. Then that's going to be problematic. We're going to do all the things humans do. But we're going to end up at a place where culturally, economically, we're going to say, if it's not biomimetic, we shouldn't be doing it.
Ah.
And at that point, everything changes.
So in other words, what you see is this principle that we've been talking about, this principle that you discovered, that I'd say Fuller discovered, that Janine Benyus named and so on, will become a principle that by proving itself, as you say, to provide wealth and reduce liability, it will at some point, we're talking the next, I guess, 37 years,
right.
It will become the principle by which we make choices.
Exactly. It's just like littering. When I was a kid, people littered everywhere on the highways and the beaches. Now they don't.
Okay. So when that becomes the question, is this the way nature would do it?
Right.
Does it this way? Does nature do it better? Does nature do it differently? When that becomes the lens through
exactly.
which everybody looks.
And it's happening right now.
Yeah.
It's actually
and of course,
happening.
The great piece, I think what will also happen, and I will end it with this, is that we will begin to say, not us here looking at how does nature do it, but us also realizing we are
exactly.
nature.
Exactly right.
And we have been a bad boy. You know, we have been misbehaving
yeah.
To the rest of us.
Yeah.
But we are nature, and so of course we will do things.
And we're waking up.
Nature
we're waking
does
up. Yeah.
Okay. So again, the book is The Shark's Paintbrush, Biomimicry and How Nature is Inspiring Innovation. To learn more, go to thesharkspaintbrush.com and packscientific.com. Thank you, Jay Harmon. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and 3 or 4 articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show.
It doesn't seem like it was that long ago that Ben Carson was tied for the lead of the 2016 Republican primary race. On November 5th, I went back and looked at the numbers over the weekend. On November 5th, Ben Carson and Trump were in a statistical tie. They each had about 25% support from Republican primary voters. 17 days later, okay, by November 22nd, Ben Carson had dropped to under 20% support. By December 8th, a couple of weeks later, he had dropped to under 14% support. By December 21st, just under 2 more weeks later, Carson was down to 10%. And currently, and this is just amazing, in an average of recent polls, Ben Carson has about 8.8% support. And now his campaign manager, Barry Bennett, and his communications director, Doug Watt, have called it quits. Let's take a look at a statement on screen here. Barry Bennett and I have resigned from the Carson campaign, effective immediately. We respect the candidate, and we have enjoyed helping him go from far back in the field to top-tier status, and apparently all the way back down to far back in the field. They don't mention that, though. Having just announced raising $23 million for the fourth quarter, more than any other Republican candidate, and passing 1 million contributions and over 600 million unique donors, what's 600? It can't be 600 million unique donors. What do they even mean? 600 MM unique donors since March? Is that 600,000? I don't know. Anyway, we are proud of our efforts for Dr. Carson, and we wish him and his campaign the best of luck. Yeah, I mean, the statement doesn't really coincide with reality in that Carson's campaign has been a total abortion. The primary problem being he doesn't really know anything, combined with the reality that the ideas he does present are either impossible or outrageous, and combine that with his bizarre, hypnotic, deadpan delivery, you don't really have a guy that can win there, do you?
Well, how do you define success? I mean, Dave, if I were to compare to many other candidates,
yeah.
I mean, he did do pretty well. And at one point, he was number two. And so,
there was a very short period where he was statistically tied for the lead.
Yeah, that's true. And so I think they did achieve something, and their efforts were not, or maybe they were in vain, but considering who we're talking about here, a guy who knows nothing, they really did accomplish quite a bit.
You're really putting a positive spin on it. I like that. The real question now is how long will Ben Carson stay in? It's not even looking like he could win any states. He might be up in Louisiana, but we don't even know because the most recent poll from there is from late September. No leads in the first 4 primary states. I think the U.S. has dodged a huge bullet here because this guy is cuckoo. I mean, this is a dangerous guy.
I guess he's pretty cuckoo. Well, we're still dealing with Trump and possibly
hey, one at a time, you know.
Cruz. So 2 more really big bullets that somehow we have to dodge. And I don't know, maybe we can pull like a Neo from the Matrix and somehow dodge these big ones.
Yeah, something's going to need to happen because there are some very, very dangerous people running on the Republican side. After the break, we will talk to an expert in populism, fascism, and totalitarianism about the difference between left-wing and right-wing left-wing and right-wing populism, something that some are confused about. That's next.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.